Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. At the dawn of the 1940s, few could boast a more exclusive address than those on Paris's renowned Avenue Foch. Home to dignitaries, socialites, and some of Europe's wealthiest citizens, in June of 1940, it would gain a new reputation as the Nazis marched into the City of Light, marking the beginning of over 4 years of German occupation. Paris was the jewel in Hitler's crown, and from the confiscated mansions of Avenue Foch, his Gestapo would hold the city in its sinister grip. What the Nazis did not know, however, was that just down the street at number 11, a stronghold of French resistance had taken root. In Avenue of Spies, a true story of terror, espionage, and one American family's heroic resistance in Nazi-occupied Paris, author and World War II historian Alex Kershaw recounts the story of one family's heroic efforts to defeat the evil in their midst. It's a great pleasure to welcome Alex Kershaw back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
Great to be with you again.
What brought you to this particular subject?
I adore France and love Paris, and I was conspiring with a couple of friends to manage to persuade a New York publisher to stump up some money so I could go and enjoy Paris for a couple of years. And lo and behold, I managed to. So, no, it was a great experience. I didn't want it to end. It was a wonderful experience.
Did you know when you went to Paris that this is the story you would follow?
I didn't know. I'd spent quite a bit of time with the leading tours for the World War II, National World War II Museum, and we would always end the Victory in Europe tour in Paris. So I'd spent quite a bit of time there, and I was convinced, I decided that wouldn't it be a great idea if I could write about Paris and spend even more time there? So I did some research, and I came across the story of the Jackson family. In fact, I came across an interview done with French radio with Philip Jackson, who is the son of Sumner Jackson, Dr. Sumner Jackson, who ran a exclusive medical practice at number 11 Avenue Foch. And I discovered to my amazement that he and his parents had joined the resistance in 1943, but they had turned their home into a hub, into a drop box for Allied agents and resistance members. And they lived literally just a few yards from the most dangerous men in all of occupied Europe, the most lethal Gestapo officers in all of France.
When you found the Jackson family, obviously that was of great interest. But then when you find the setting, when you find Avenue Foch, is everything just come together at that point?
Absolutely. Without that context, without that those neighbors to create the tension throughout the narrative, it would have been a good story. It's a beautiful story about an upper middle class family that put everything on the line. But without that broader context, without the villains, the ultimate villains that lived beside them, it wouldn't have had that notion of espionage. It wouldn't have had the tension that you needed to create what I wanted to create, which was a real life thriller, a true thriller.
Tell us a little bit what our baseline knowledge should be about the Jackson family.
Sumner Jackson was born in Maine, good Yankee, born into poverty, finally qualified as a doctor, served in the First World War with great distinction with the Harvard Medical Unit as a combat surgeon. One of the nurses in the surgery in Paris where he worked was a woman called Toquette, Swiss-born, and they married. And he eventually became the head doctor at the American Hospital of Paris. When the Nazis arrived, he decided to stay on because without his leadership, the hospital would have been taken over by the Nazis. In the early years of the occupation, he became involved in an escape line run by the Liberation Resistance Network and helped to ferry downed airmen, mostly British guys at that stage of the war, down an escape line to Spain. And then from Spain, these men managed to get back home. But it wasn't until 1943 that a neighbor of the Jacksons literally knocked on their front door, 11 Avenue Foch, and walked into their home and met with Tocquet and said to Tocquet, would you be prepared to use your home for the resistance? Mm. And this gentleman is now 94. He's called Francis Deloche de Noyelle. He'd grown up right next door, literally, to the Jetsons at 11 Avenue Foch. And he's still alive and well, and I managed to interview him at great length in Paris. And he told me that when he walked into that living room and faced Tocquet and told her, by the way, I'm in the resistance, will you join us, will you help us? Knowing that if she said yes, she would put everything on the line, including her husband's life and her only son's life. She didn't hesitate for a second, he told me. She was a fierce patriot and risked everything, literally everything, by helping the resistance.
You beautifully tell that story in the book, and I'm interested because you would think the reaction would be that even if you were for that you would have to think and have to be persuaded in some way, shape, or form.
Or consult your husband.
Yes.
And she didn't. There was not
some
a moment
sort of spousal approval.
Yeah, it was not a moment of hesitation. And you know what's incredible is you think about the Jacksons were well known. That they were the American family, French-American family that lived at number 11. They'd been there since the 20s. Jackson ran a very successful medical practice there. And one of the wonderful things about the property, it was what was called a res de chaussée, a ground floor apartment with two entrances. It's perfect for the resistance. You know, here, a well-known doctor working there. They had two exits. This was a perfect place to be, a drop box, to drop off information and to gather intelligence agents and for the resistance to meet in. But it was number 11 Avenue Foch on an avenue that was known by 1942-43 as Avenue Boche. Everybody in Paris was afraid of going there because they knew that that's where the Gestapo were headquartered. The Nazi secret police had their headquarters at number 72. The counterintelligence for the Gestapo, the most successful spy hunter in the Third Reich, had his headquarters at number 84. At number 55, there was another Gestapo office. And at number 31, even closer to the Jacksons, was Theodor Daneker's office. And Theodor Daneker was the Gestapo officer directly responsible for the deportation and murder of 80,000 French Jews. So there was no more evil street to be based on if you were in resistance anywhere in Europe.
In going to the door and asking that question, how much of just the asking came from the location or the residents of that home, of the Jacksons themselves?
That's a great question. It was both. De Noyelle, 94 years old today, told me that he knew that he could trust the Jacksons. His parents were very close friends with the Jacksons. He'd grown up playing with Philip Jackson, his sister, who was a very good friend of Philip Jackson. They were good people, he told me. They could be trusted. But also the location was superb. It was absolutely superb. Interestingly, when the Jacksons were, I'm not jumping too far ahead, but the Jacksons were eventually arrested by the milice, the far-right paramilitary force that grew up around the Vichy regime. And then they were handed over to the Gestapo in France, and eventually the whole family was deported into Nazi Germany. And Francis Deloche de Noyelle, who had recruited Tocquet to the resistance, found out almost immediately, he told me, within hours, that the family had been arrested. And he felt enormous guilt. To this day, I think he still feels great guilt. He told me when I interviewed him in Paris that, you know, he never went back to the Jackson home, even after the war. He survived the war, obviously. Tocquet survived. And he never went back and saw her ever again because he felt such tremendous guilt. He was the one who was directly responsible for the fate of that family.
Was the guilt that he felt, was there any animosity that we know of toward him?
No, actually what happened was that Francis Deloche de Noyelle's father went and saw Tocquet, literally walked 5 yards, knocked on the door, and went and saw her. And he said, you know, my son is very sorry for what happened, and it's terrible what happened to your family. And she said, if your son hadn't come and invited us to join the resistance, we could not have held our heads high after the war. We were proud to do our part for de Gaulle and for the French resistance.
In the interviews with Philip Jackson, what did he have to say?
Everything. I mean, I was extremely, extremely fortunate to have a living source. I met with him many times. He has rooms at the Les Invalides, where the creme de la creme of the French resistance now reside. And he was very, very helpful. And what was wonderful for me was that I was able to take a 12-year-old boy in 1940 and follow him through to manhood. It's a sort of Bildungsroman, a coming-of-age story, right through to when he was 17 in 1945 at the end of the war. So you have this, I try to have this very delicate and very human point of view throughout the narrative, which he was able to provide to me because he had a fantastic memory.
Alex Kershaw is the author of the new book, Avenue of Spies, The True Story of Terror, Espionage, and One American Family's Heroic Resistance in Nazi-Occupied Paris. It is published by Crown. You mentioned the love you have of Paris and wanting to, not only wanting to spend time in Paris, but wanting to set a book in Paris. What is there, have you been able to do what so many authors have tried to do, which is scratch and figure out what there is about the place that is so magical, and ultimately a city that is able to go through what it went through that you recount in the book and remain as magical?
I think if you have a developed any kind of aesthetic, wine, food, beautiful women, beautiful places, it's a living museum. I mean, if you walk around Paris, there are very few cities in the world which are, it's like walking through a giant, beautifully maintained museum. It's a truly gorgeous place. I think that all writers romanticize Paris. From Hemingway onwards, every writer has kind of perhaps who loves Europe and loves France has secretly wanted to go and live there and get drunk and write about it and get paid to do so. So, you know, I remember reading Hemingway's A Movable Feast, yes, which is just a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. I think it's my favorite Hemingway book. And you can feel the enthusiasm for a place that's very, very sensual. It's a very, very beautiful place with perhaps the most cultured and most beautiful and refined city still in Europe. It's a wonderful place to not only to write about, but to actually experience.
In that experience, you were there for almost 4 years.
On and off. I'm based here in the Northeast. I actually live in Williamstown in Massachusetts, but I went over as often as I could and really enjoyed myself when I was there. I spent a lot of time in the archives and meeting with Philip and exploring his childhood haunts, walking up and down the Avenue Foch. I must have walked up and down the Avenue Foch 50 times. Mm. And what's wonderful about it is that nothing's changed. The building, number 11 Avenue Foch, looks exactly as it did in 1940. The same black iron railings outside. If you walk along Avenue Foch, all the buildings are pretty much the same as they were when the Nazis had turned it into Avenue Boche. You can look up to number 84. If you go to number 84 Avenue Foch, you can look up to the fifth floor where before World War II, there were maids' quarters, and during World War II, where the Gestapo tortured some of the bravest of the brave British agents that they captured in France. So it's a remarkable place to go because you really feel like nothing's changed.
You are certainly an acclaimed World War II historian, and as you mentioned earlier, you were guiding tours on World War II. I'm curious as to how much of what you learned was a surprise.
I was surprised by several things. I was surprised by the fact that the French themselves willingly and in many cases happily deported 80,000 French citizens to their deaths, most of them in Auschwitz, that the French police at the heart of Paris in July of 1942 went and stormed into many Jews' homes and separated mothers from children and then placed them on buses that the French owned and then happily helped the SS, worked hand in glove with the SS to remove French citizens from the heart of the City of Light before, in front of everyone. You know, you couldn't not live in the center of Paris and not know, not hear the screams in July of 1942 when the French helped deport their own citizens. That surprised me, that level of collaboration, that willingness to commit mass murder.
What do you think it was about that allowed that to even happen?
vast, virulent anti-Semitism that you still find in Europe. And, you know, you only have to look at what's really going on in Europe and look at what's been happening in France recently, and it's disturbing. There's been a residue of anti-Semitism that still rears up and is very disturbing. I think one other thing that I was really struck by was just how dangerous it was to belong to the resistance and just how mentally exhausting it was. I came across an anecdotal, probably an apocryphal story about how by the spring of 1944, on the eve of D-Day, the mental hospitals in Paris were full of people who had nervous breakdowns who belonged to the resistance. Now, I'm not sure whether that's true or not, but it made me think. The stress, you know, Toquette, every time someone knocked on the front door, she didn't know whether it was a member of the resistance or a guy in a Gestapo uniform who lived just down the block. You never knew what might happen next. And that tension, that stress of being constantly involved in a private war where you would be instantly shot in many cases, became too much for many people. They just couldn't deal with the tension. In fact, that it wore down the Jacksons themselves. Just before they were arrested, they were really exhausted. They were mentally exhausted by the stress of operating this private war and being part of the Army of the Shadows, not knowing what might happen at any moment, not knowing if their son would also pay the ultimate price for their heroism.
This gets back to an earlier question, but do you think there was ever regret?
Very good question. It's, you know, I was not able, unfortunately, to interview Toquette after the war. She lost her husband. She lost the great love of her life.
Right.
And her son went through hell and was very, very, very lucky to survive. She went through a year of Ravensbrück. Amazingly, at 59, survived the Auschwitz concentration camp at Ravensbrück, and her health was ruined forever. So did she, in darker moments when she missed her husband and looked back? Maybe, I don't know. But I suspect that perhaps not. I suspect that she was such a fierce spirit, such a patriot, such a someone that was so committed to defeating Nazism and so proud of her French heritage and Swiss heritage that I suspect perhaps not. I don't know. It's a very good question. I didn't come across anything that suggested that she did regret what she'd done, because she was really the one that decided to put the family's lives on the line.
And if not regret, even having, and we talked about this, of the quick decision of fully thinking it through, that it was going to affect you every time you moved and walked out of that home.
Absolutely. And, you know, before the Nazis arrived in Paris, Sumner had said to Toquette, let's go back to America. Let's take Philip, our son. You come back with me. Let's go to where it's safe. And Toquette said, no, I'm not going to do that. She'd already been to the U.S. in the early 20s and tried to make a life here and had been very, very unhappy, and had said to Sumner, it's either me or the U.S. Choose which one you love most. And he chose Toquette and went back to France. On the eve of the Nazis arriving in Paris, she again refused to abandon the city that she loved so much. And he finally said, look, you're leaving with our son. I'm going to stay and manage the American hospital, but you are finally going to leave. And she did so. So in a way, you know, maybe she regretted not going to the U.S. in 1940 before the Nazis arrived. That you never know it. So she was a very strong-willed woman that mostly got her way.
I'm curious as to just your process of working with this subject, because as you mentioned, you've had this great fortune in many cases in this book of having the subject still be alive. That as each day passes in your line of work as a World War II historian, that obviously gets harder and harder. How important ultimately is it, and are we doing a good enough job of chronicling these stories and finding out all aspects of what happened?
That's a great question. I think that a lot of people have made very concerted efforts. I certainly know of a lot of people that have spent, you know, the last 10 or 15 years working very hard to record the voices and the stories of a generation which will not be with us in 5 or 10 years' time. The youngest veteran of World War II, legal veteran, who served in World War II, is now 90 years old. So we're seeing the sunset days of a wonderful, wonderful group of people. I think that one thing that has not been done enough is an attempt to humanize and add emotion and real feeling to these stories. There are plenty of academics that are very happy to spend their entire lives in archives, but are a little bit more hesitant about actually forming a relationship with someone who went through trauma. I have enjoyed that enormously. I don't mean that in a perverse way.
Sure.
The friendships I've formed and the relationship I have with Philip and others over the last 15 years have been, you know, I'm prouder of those relationships than almost anything else in my life. But an awful lot of people don't want to get that close. They don't want to spend weeks and weeks getting inside someone's soul and inside their head and sharing those experiences in too intimate a way. So I think, I don't know, I mean, I'm talking from my own experience. I think the emotion is very important. It's crucial to get the facts right, but then you have to make people care. And that means you have to really make people feel. And that takes an awful lot of time because you have to get those feelings and those emotions from the people you're interviewing.
And it is, of course, a two-way street. There has to be trust on both sides.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for them to tell perhaps a story of the most horrific moments of their life, but I assume, at least where you're concerned, that's where experience comes in because you've heard so many of these stories. You have a sense.
I think so. I mean, I've been a journalist for almost 30 years now, and I've talked to World War II veterans for on and off for about 20 years. And what I do is I really listen to trauma. I listen to people relate trauma. Certainly when you're talking about combat, etc., World War II veterans, they're talking about the most, you know, they're talking about events that were like car crashes. I mean, I remember one veteran said to me that, you know, the reason why I came home and never talked about it with my family, didn't mention the word about the war, is because, you know, I was in a car crash, a very traumatic car crash, every day for 511 days. The last thing I wanted to do was talk about the most painful experience in my life. And this is, you know, this goes to the question that everybody asks. Why didn't these guys come back after the war and talk about it openly?
Right.
Well, I wouldn't want to talk about nearly dying every day and seeing people blown to pieces to anyone, least of all the things that you held most pure, your wife, your family. You don't want to infect them with darkness. You don't want to darken their view of the world or humanity. And you have, you know, 21 year old guys coming back from seeing things which were deeply, deeply offensive and disturbing and really, in many cases, destroyed their faith in humanity. They didn't want to come back and share that with what they felt was precious and innocent and beautiful, you know, the people back home.
And it may not even be a case of where they are closeting the trauma. In some cases, it's simply that they don't even see it as trauma.
And also they've, you know, there have been several cases where I've interviewed people and they suddenly remember things. And I'm sitting in a room with them in their kitchen or the living room, and they are back on Omaha Beach, 6th of June, 1944. They're right back where they didn't want to be. So you sit there quietly and you listen to the story, and it's, you know, you're immensely privileged, but you've just actually experienced almost in real time their traumatic memory of something quite incredible. One of the most, you know, Omaha Beach, first wave, D-Day, the most deadly part of that beach. That's a hell of a place to have been and experienced. You made a huge difference by being there.
Right.
What you suffered there made a huge difference.
In finishing this book, besides feeling quite inadequate,
I'm talking about me now, yes?
No, I just
hope.
I mean, these are just an amazing story of an amazing things that are being done. Ultimately, what do you hope people get out of the story in the book?
I think that I want people to be moved. You know, if a tear comes to your eye, that would be wonderful, because I think that's the whole point of art, is to move people. And I'm an historian that is struggling to also be an artist. I want this to be a great read. I want it to be to be beautiful, and if it can be. But I think ultimately I want people to remember that even in the darkest places, even in Ravensbrück, even on the Avenue Foch, there was still hope. They were not all monsters. There are cases where humanity can really rise above evil. It's ultimately an inspiring story about people that risked everything and made a difference.
The new book is Avenue of Spies. It is published by Crown. Alex Kershaw, great pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great honor.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Avenue of Spies, a true story of terror, espionage, and one American family's heroic resistance in Nazi-occupied Paris. The book is published by Crown. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can also listen to this again or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.